Mike Hester, I need to put you on the spot. I forgot to get somebody for share time. Can you do share time right after the sermon? I knew I was forgetting something. Well, good morning.
Good morning.
We are in the book of Exodus, as I'm sure you are well aware, if you have been here lately. Chapter 15, we're getting close to being halfway through the book. It seems to me like we just started not long ago. If you have an outline, you see I've entitled the message this morning, Principled Living. We'll be looking at the last six verses of Exodus chapter 15. Just sort of as a review, you remember in chapter 14, the children of Israel crossed the Red Sea miraculously as God parted the waters, blew back the waters with the east wind, and they crossed the Red Sea, the text says, on dry land. He didn't just blow the waters back, he dried the ground as well. They went across, the Egyptian army followed them, or attempted to follow them. God confused the Egyptian army and then collapsed the water in upon them and drowned them. I've tried to imagine the scene on the other side of the Red Sea where the Israelites were as they witnessed this resounding defeat from the hand of God upon the Egyptians. And surely it was one of awe. Surely it was one of fear. But I think also there was a sense of relief, a sense of safety. It seemed like that Red Sea would have coming back in would have, in their minds, provided a barrier of safety from those who were pursuing them. Now, I know, I think of that, and I think, well, the Egyptians had boats. You know, the Red Sea was not that much of an obstacle to keep you from going across. However, would you, if you were an Egyptian, would you have crossed the Red Sea on a boat about then? Not me. Not me. It'd been a while before I had that nerve, right, after witnessing that. So the Israelites are on the other side, and there commences to be a celebration, a worship of God. And John looked at this last week, the Song of Moses, the first 21 verses of Exodus chapter 15, where they sing and celebrate God's deliverance. And then that brings us to where we're at this morning. If you see on your outline, I've got some words in red. Sometimes, always, and most of the time. All right? A lot of times, there's a fourth one for you. A lot of times when I use the word sometimes, it's kind of providing me a way out. Okay, sometimes I want to say all the time, but I don't want to be very dogmatic, so I kind of leave me a escape route by this word sometimes. And sometimes I do that, all right? You see that word three times. You see the word always. The word always doesn't leave me much wiggle room. I'm being pretty firm when I use that word. And then the last time, it is most of the time. So kind of keep those ideas in your mind as we go through here. The first two points are just kind of with a review, kind of taking, looking back a little bit as we come to, and then with the third point we begin, we'll be at our text this morning. But the first point is this, the first statement is this, that sometimes God delivers us when we don't expect it. We don't expect deliverance. When the Israelites were on the west side of the Red Sea and saw the Egyptian army approaching, do you think they expected God to deliver them? They sure didn't act like it, did they? I think what they were expecting was to be hauled back to Egypt and enslaved even harsher than they had ever been. And God just up and delivers them. He saves them. He blesses them with deliverance. It wasn't because they sowed the seed of faith. It wasn't because they named it and claimed it. It wasn't any of those things, in spite of their unbelief, in spite of their talking against God and against Moses, God delivers. I would venture to say, if I could accurately record my life, the good things that God has done for me, the deliverances, the blessings that God has dumped on me, has more often than not been times when I didn't expect it. I wasn't striving for it necessarily. God just blessed me. God just delivered me. God just helped me. Point number two. Sometimes we think we will live on that mountaintop the rest of our lives. God has done something great for us, and we think, man, this is going to be my life from now on. God has helped me. Here I am. And our thinking kind of goes like what I've got listed there. God has done great things for us. God must really love me. Since God really loves me, I will see lots of great things from God. It's kind of like the popular book, Your Best Life Now, Joel Osteen. And for a lot of people, now is probably their best life. But we're on the mountaintop. God has done something, and we think, man, this is my life from now on. Things are going to be easy. I'm going to be on the mountaintop. As the saying goes, we're in tall cotton now. Okay? Probably not very many people in here know where that saying came from, right? But you're in tall cotton now. Then number three, we're at our text for the day. Sometimes we're wrong. We think we're going to live on the mountaintop for the rest of our life, but sometimes we're wrong. That's not the case. In our text this morning, look at verses 22, 23. They finished their celebration and they're moving out. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea. Then they went out into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. Now when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore the name of it was called Marah. God has just delivered them, and now they set foot, or they set on their path to go where God is leading them. Remember, the cloud is in front of them, leading them on their way. They go 3 days, and their water supply is gone. And they don't find any water. Finally, they come to this place, a spring or whatever it may be, but the water, something about the water, it says it's bitter, is undrinkable. I don't know if it was, that means it's poisonous as well, but they could not drink this water. The mountaintop has gone. The mountaintop experience has gone. So that's where they find themselves. The mountaintop is gone. Didn't last near as long as they thought. The mountaintop experience lasted 3 days. And now they're experiencing heartache. They're experiencing trouble. Number four, trials as well as unprincipled living, always, here's one of my always words, trials as well as unprincipled living always reveal things, what would you put in that? Always reveal things blank you. About. We think that that's the word I'm going to use, but it's not. All right? It is true that trials and undisciplined living will always reveal things about you. Yes, they do. But things revealed about you are seen. That's the implications are they are seen by who? Somebody else. All right, I'm going to put a different word there. Trials as well as undisciplined living will always reveal things to you. To you. We hope. All right? Let's read verses 24 and 25. And the people complained against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" So he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. When he cast it into the waters were made sweet. Now this is interesting. I understand the story at that point. And there it is. But then we read this. There he made a statute and an ordinance for them, and there he tested them. Now I want to ask you the question. I've got two things in my statement there. Trials as well as undisciplined living. What is the difference between a trial and undisciplined living? This is my philosophy along those lines, answering that question. A trial in your life is something that is unexplainable. Something bad that has happened to you that you cannot put your finger on why it happened. You don't know why it happened. Unprincipled living is different. Unprincipled living is bad things that happen to you, but you very well know why they happened to you. Right, a person is an alcoholic, and he destroys his life, he destroys his marriage through undisciplined living. And heartaches come. He loses his wife, he loses his life, he loses his health. Is this a trial? No. He very well knows why he's experiencing it. He may try to act like it's not and it's something else and deny and all this kind of stuff, but that is not a trial. You waste your income on frivolous things and then lose your house. That's not a trial sent to you like Job. It's not. That's the consequences of undisciplined living. A teenage boy turns 16 and begins to drive, and he drives his parents' car 90 miles an hour and wrecks it. He has learned nothing. Usually it takes several events like that before his undisciplined living sinks in, or at least if all teenage boys were like me, that's kind of the case. Undisciplined living is not a trial. Here, the text says God tested them. God tested them. The waters we see here appear to be bitter. The bitter waters seem to me to be a trial for them. These trials and these tests are to inform you, not God. God knows what you are like. When you go through a trial, they are to teach you. They are to show you how you would respond or how I would respond when faced with this trial. The children of Israel, we see, how did they respond? With murmuring and complaining and griping. We see how they responded. They saw how they responded to this trial. We see how we respond to undisciplined living. We see how we respond to trials as well. Now, we're going to have a little exercise here. Why is it that one person's life is full of chaos and another person's life seems peaceful and serene? Let me ask a little more specific question. Think of one area in your life that seems to be calm. that things seem to be going the way they ought to be going. Maybe it's just your marriage. Maybe your marriage, you and your spouse are really at one with one another. You don't fuss and fight and feud and slap and yell and all this kind of stuff. Things are okay. You're in agreement. You walk the same path. Maybe that's your marriage. Maybe it is peaceful. Maybe it's okay. Or maybe it's your finances or your relationship with your kids or your kids' relationship as adults or whatever. Can you think of some area in your life that things, for the most part, for years have gone, and I don't mean to qualify it with years as in a long period of time, but that things are going well? Can you think of an area? Some of you got a look on your face like you can't think of not one area. Think of one area. Now, then I'll ask you this question. Don't answer it out loud, because you're liable to get embarrassed. Why is that area of your life that way? Why is that area of your life that way? Why is your marriage good? Why is your finances stable? Why are your finances stable? So right now you're thinking, trying to answer that question. Now, I don't know how you answer that question. Here's how I answer it. Let's say it's my marriage. Why is my marriage peaceful and serene? So am I thinking of the answer to that question? I'm thinking, well, we just love one another. I love her. She loves me. We've learned not to fight over insignificant things. We this, we that, I this, I that. And somewhere along the line, I shake myself and I think, you fool. It is not you. It is not her. It is God's grace. And then I ask myself a follow-up question. Why did God grace my marriage, or whatever the issue is, in that way? Why did God give us grace? So I answer that question. I this, I that. I haven't learned anything, have I? She this, she that, we this, we that. And again, I shake myself and say, you idiot. Here you are again. It's not you. It is God. It is God's grace. Now, I would venture to guess, as you ask yourself those questions, you come and kind of go through the same process. Why are things going well? Because I did this. Because I did that. Where do we get those ideas? I'll tell you where we get them. From text just like this. From the two verses that follow are an example of where we get those ideas. Stay with me. This is point number five. Conditional promises always have conditions. Does that make sense? Conditional promises always have conditions. Let's read the verses 25 or 26, just one verse, verse 26. So God, Moses cries out to God. God shows him a tree, puts it in the water, it becomes sweet, and it says, there God tested them. And God said this to them, verse 26, if you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I'm going to insert a word, then I will put none of the diseases on you, which I brought upon the Egyptians. For I am the Lord who heals you. Now here we see a conditional promise that God makes to the Israelites. All right, there are four conditions. And you might say there one or four ways of saying the same thing over and over and over, and I'm not going to argue that point. We get the point with all four of them. But listen to the four. If you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God, and if you do what is right in God's sight, and if you give ear to his commandments, and if you keep all his statutes. There's the four conditions that are to be met for the promise to follow. Then I will keep you. I will heal you. I will not put upon you all the diseases and judgments that I put upon the Egyptians. This is an example, and the Bible is full of these, of if-then statements. Now, I feel like I'm fixing to lose about half of you here, because we're talking about a system of reason, a logical system, all right? Logical statements. Years ago, we were always in small group Bible studies, and went through, and been involved in dozens of different Bible studies. Only one study that was ever in, did we just drop it and not complete it. We just didn't finish it. And the name of the study was Better Thinking and Reasoning. And it was a textbook on logic. Most of the men liked it. Most of the women hated it. And therefore, we dropped it. We didn't finish it. But this is, I'm not going to go through the whole textbook. This is just a short thing, and you need to kind of grasp this before we go on to the next point. So there's an if-then statement. In our text, what is the if part of it? Keep my commandments. Let's just summarize it there. If you keep my commandments. There's the condition. What is the promise? I will heal you. We're going to condense it to that word. Then I will heal you. There's the condition. There's the promise. Okay? Now here's where it gets abstract. We're going to say, if A, then B. If you keep my commandments, then I'll heal you. If A, then B. Everybody with me? Let's flip that around. If, and the A's and B's still mean the same thing. Okay? If B... Let me back up a second. That's a valid statement. If A, then B. If you keep my commandments, then I'll heal you. We assume that's a valid promise. Why do we assume it? Because God said it. All right, so we know that's true. Let's flip it around. If God heals you, then did he keep you keep his commandments? Is that a valid statement? It's not. Let me give you an example of that. Suppose I take my pocket knife and I give it to Don Tibbett and open it up and tell him to stab it through my hand. If he stabs it through my hand, then I will bleed. Right? That's two assumptions there. One is that I've got blood in me. And the second is that I've got a heart to pump it out. Okay? So if he stabs me, then I will bleed. We flip that around. If I am bleeding, then he has stabbed me. No, not necessarily. I can bleed for a lot of other reasons than him stabbing me, right? So that's the converse of our statement, and we see the converse is not necessarily true. Okay? We're going to take another different arrangement there. This is called the contrapositive. You take the negative, turn it around, and make them both negative. If not be, see, I told you. Hang on. If not be, then not A. All right? In our story with me and Don, if I am not bleeding, then he has not stabbed me. Is that a valid statement? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. We're almost there. With our text today, if God does not deliver the Israelites from the diseases and the judgments he put on the Egyptians, then they have not kept his commandments. That's a valid statement. All right? Now, think of this just for a minute. The contrapositive, the negative flipped around there, is always a valid statement of the original. Except. Okay? In logic, it always is. The exception here is because God occasionally makes exceptions in this area. And this area is trials. That's why trials are difficult for us to understand, because they are unreasonable. At least that's one reason. They contradict logic. And we think, why? How is this? But there's more to it than that. We have a condition to meet. In this text, there are four conditions to meet. I want to read them slowly, one at a time, and you check off a box from 1 to 10, 1 being I'm sorry at this, 10 to be being perfection. You check off the box of how well you have met these conditions. If you, me as well, okay? If you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God. Have you diligently heeded the voice of God? 1 to 10. Don't tell me. We're not going to need 6 through 10, are we? I don't imagine. I haven't. How many times do I have to not diligently heed God's voice to not qualify? Once. If you do what is right in his sight, check your box. If you give ear to his commandments, if you keep all his statutes. It's a little tough keeping these conditions, isn't it? There's a phrase that is one of my pet peeves. You probably have heard me say something similar to this. You might recognize it before. But I've heard it off and on all of my life, but I can remember specifically when I was 14 or 15 years old, maybe 16, I'm not sure, in church setting with our church family, the people that were in church, and I had a friend or a guy that went to church there, was about my age, teenager, who had went off the deep end. He'd went wild. He'd went astray. And I remember hearing his parents making this statement to another adult family, that adult person there, may have been my parents, say, I don't know what happened. We did the best we could. And I, as a teenager, wanted to say, no, you didn't. I didn't say it because I had enough respect or sense or whatever. No, you didn't. Why did I think that? Because I knew them. Not that I knew their son. I knew them enough. I didn't know them just really, really well. But I knew them enough to know that was not true. And I know you enough. I don't care how new you are here. I know you enough to tell you, you have not done the best you could. You haven't. I haven't. I have not done the best I could do. Well, if that's the case, then what good is this kind of statement? For one thing, it shows you that you haven't done the best you could do. If you're honest, it ought to show you, for me to be able to meet these conditions, it's something going to be something greater than me. It's going to be something that's more than just what's in me. And that's what we come to with the last point. Most of the time, principled living leads to peace and rest. We see in verse 27, then they came to Elim, where there were 12 wells of water and 70 palm trees. And they camped there by those waters. Principled living begins and ends with humility. We may try to do the best we can, and our heart might be, and see, I'm making statements that are on the verge of being dishonest. Our hearts want to do what's right. Truthfully, my heart doesn't always want to do what's right. But I say, I want to do what's right. You know you want to do what's right. You understand how I'm using that. We have decisions to make, and we try to make them with as much wisdom as we can. But undergirding all of that, you need and I need a spirit of humility that recognizes my human frailty. I cannot do this on my own. Now, I've got a statement there. This is original with me. So it may not be right. Okay, but you just think about it for a while. And if you don't like it, don't tell me, okay? Principled living is grace disguised as a lot of things. Principled living is grace disguised as sound reason. It's grace disguised as wisdom. It's grace disguised as experience. It's grace disguised as righteousness. It's grace disguised as holy living. Principled living is this. I may see Don Tibbett, and I know things about Don. And I may look at Don in a general light of a person who makes wise decisions. I see wise decisions. But the cloak around that I don't see is grace. God graces his life with wise decisions. I may look at some of you and see you making financial decisions, living financially in a wise manner. I see that. What really is there is God gracing your life with those things. When I think rightly, when I think soberly, when I think in a righteous manner, and things go well for me, my heart overflows with gratitude. Because I know if my life were left to my own devices, if my decisions and my life were made left to my own decisions, my own degree of wisdom and intelligence, I would surely fail. When I think soberly, I can't help but say, thank you, God. Thank you, God. The children of Israel have been tested at Marah. And I don't want to grade them on their test. But God told them, this is a test. This is a trial. It's to show you something about yourself. If you will walk with God, if you will follow Him, and all wrapped into those conditions are lives of grace, lives of grace, hearts of humility, God will bless your life. God will bless my life. Be grateful, acknowledging where your good gift, perfect gift, what does James say? It's from above. It comes down from the Father of lights. Let's be grateful, will we? Let's pray. God, help us to not be so hung up on ourselves. Help us to not be so proud of ourselves, so dependent upon ourselves. God, help us to see that everything we have comes from a gracious God. Even the love that we have for you is a gift from you. God, give us gratitude. Help us to be reminded of it daily. God, would you bring this back to my mind tomorrow, this afternoon, Tuesday, Wednesday. Continually, God, give me a heart of gratitude. Amen.